So what is PCI? PCI stands for the Peripheral Component Interconnect, which is really just a fancy way of saying it's an I.O. architecture. It's the most successful I.O. architecture in history. Basically, every single Linux platform can be hooked up to a PCI bus, even if, in the case of S390, that's through having an emulated S390 on a PCI card. It was introduced in 1992 by the PCI Special Interest Group, which has, as of last count, around 840 members. It spawned a lot of different related technologies, some designed to replace it, and some designed to enhance it. Mini PCI is that technology used in my laptop anyway to connect the onboard wired networking and the modem. Card bus, you see plugged into the side of pretty much every laptop here. PCIX is used by servers. PCIX is used by servers for when you need higher bandwidth connections. AGP has become the graphics bus of choice, and it's very closely related to PCI. Compact PCI is used in industrial applications, and it supports hot pluggable, as do some PCI implementations on other architectures. And PCI Express is the newcomer, designed as a complete replacement for PCI. It nevertheless remains compatible with PCI in a number of important ways. As I said, PCI was first introduced in June 92, but we didn't actually get a specification to let us plug cards into that bus until 93. In its very first form, it was only available for use on the motherboard of the computer. By 1995, we'd outgrown the limitations of a 33 megahertz bus, so they came up with a 66 megahertz specification. PCIX in September 99 came out, and that doubled the bandwidth again, doubled the frequency again to 133 megahertz, giving us about a gigabyte of bandwidth for each card. The protocol, the main protocol, got revised in March 2002 to version 2.3, and then 3.0 in August 2002. Nothing particularly interesting in those revisions. It was mostly just clarifications. And as people implemented different parts of the protocol, they found better ways to do some things. It's all very evolutionary up to this point. PCIX 2.0 introduces a 16-bit bus. Up to that point, there'd been 32 and 64-bit buses. And then PCI Express comes along and completely changes everything. Just to compare the hardware a little bit, PCI is a bus. If you take a look at a PCI card, you'll see that there's lots and lots of pins on it. This is kind of expensive for some systems. I mean, this sound card, the margin to the manufacturer on this sound card is probably less than a dollar. So anything they can do to squeeze a few extra cents out of each card makes a big impact on their bottom line. So PCI Express, minimum number of pins you can have is 4. And that's going to be a huge saving for the manufacturers. As I said, PCI and PCI Express have this bus, and it's 32 bits wide by default. PCIX 2 introduces a 16-bit bus. And again, that's supposed to be used in very price-sensitive applications. Originally, when PCI was introduced, the signaling levels on the bus were set to be 5 volts. And over time, they've been transitioning that down to a 3.3-volt signaling bus. There's several of these cards can be plugged into either 3-volt or 5-volt buses, but the older ones are still 5 volts only. So PCI Express, they changed that completely. It's a differential signaling bus. So instead of having a reference voltage and then going up to 5, bring the line up to 5 volts and bring the line back down to the ground, they don't do that anymore. They have two pins to transmit and two pins to receive, and each of those pins is driven in opposite directions at the same time. And it goes really fast. These pins are clocked at 2.5 gigabits per second. So the PCI, the plain PCI protocol, is very, very simple. There are address line, there are 32 or 64 lines used for address or data, and there are some other pins that tell the card which phase of the transaction the bus is in, and therefore whether those should be interpreted as addresses or as data. And it's all done as transactions, so we know that there's going to be an address phase, and then there'll be one or more data phases, and then the bus will go free and somebody else can get on the bus. PCI Express changes that completely as well. It looks much, much, much more like a networking layer. At the bottom you have a physical layer, and on top of that there's a data link layer, and on top of that there's a transaction layer, which is the bit that you're actually interested in as a software person. There were a lot of sideband signals in the original PCI specification. For example, there were interrupt lines, 4 different interrupt lines on the connector. And those have been done away with by PCI Express. Instead, when you want to generate an interrupt, another packet, there's a type of packet that says an interrupt was raised. And again, this is all in order to reduce the pin count as low as possible. Here's a diagram. Wow, it actually worked quite well. That diagram is taken straight out of the PCI Express specification, showing the transaction layer, data link layer, and the physical layer. Now, when you're designing a system, you put together a system topology. This mainly comes into effect for bigger boxes. Your PC sitting at home probably has one PCI bus, and maybe two if you're lucky. But in theory, and on the larger machines, such as the ones that my company manufactures, you can have a lot of different PCI bridges. The example on the left-hand side here shows an example of 3 buses. There's a host bridge, bridging to PCI bus 0 by convention. Then, in order to expand, to have more expansion slots, there's this second PCI bridge. And then one card that's plugged into the PCI bus has a PCI to PCI bridge, such as this one, bridging to multiple devices on the same card, yet on a different PCI bus. PCI Express is considerably more complicated. There's a root complex, and you can see the root complex here. The root complex takes the role of the host bridge. But instead of having a bus coming out of it, it has multiple PCI Express connections. And some of those, as you can see here, go to PCI Express endpoints, like this one, and these ones down here. And some go to a switch, and a PCI Express switch can internally be thought of having a bus, but it's entirely up to the implementation whether or not there's a bus involved, or whether it's just done through some magic fairies. One important thing is that PCI Express, there has to be a transition period from PCI to PCI Express. We're not all going to change overnight. So there is a PCI Express to PCI Bridge specification, and that allows us to continue using all our legacy cards. There are several legacy parts of PCI that have been done away with in PCI Express. One of these is the notion of having a special VGA card. And that used to make the Linux PCI code really, really complicated, because you had to know whether, for any given bridge, you had to know whether there was a VGA device anywhere underneath this bridge, because you had to program the bridges specially so they would accept all kinds of random transactions on behalf of the bridge, the VGA card that was underneath them. And that's all gone. Also, there were ISA bridges, and thankfully ISA is dead. I'm getting to that at the end. So, address spaces. When you do a PCI transaction, you give it an address and then some data. And the address can be in one of several different address spaces. There's IO port space, referenced by INB, OUTB, and all those other wonderful legacy things. It's a 16-bit address space, and it is deprecated. They do plan to remove support for it from future revisions of the PCI spec. It's very inefficient. There are a lot of cards which expose the same register set through a memory mapped address and an IO port address. And using the memory mapped addresses is almost invariably faster, because there are all kinds of assumptions about INB. It has to take a set amount of time, coincidentally, the same amount of time it would take if it were on an 8 megahertz ISA bus. And that's not so great when you've got a 2.4 gigahertz processor sitting around waiting for a simulated ISA bus. So memory mapped is really where it's at. It can be a 32-bit or 64-bit address. And you access these in Linux through the use of readB and writeB. Now, they are memory mapped. In theory, you could just dereference that address and get something back. But A, it looks ugly. And B, some architectures and some platforms have real trouble getting the exact right semantics from readB and writeB, such as getting endianness right and getting ordering rules right. And so we abstract that away with the readB, writeB set of functions. And we can act as if the whole world's same. And then you can access configuration space with routines wonderfully named PCI read config byte, and then word, dword, etc. You don't need to do this very much under Linux, because all the standard things that are in the configuration space are actually cached for you in the PCI dev. And you can just go and dereference that structure directly and get the values out that have been cached there for you. So what does PCI Express do with all this? Well, it expands the configuration space to 4,096 bytes. Under regular PCI, it's only 256 bytes. But they've started to need to configure more things. So they said, OK, we'll expand the configuration space. PCI Express also adds message space. And in a message space, you can send control messages to different devices. Remember I said that PCI Express was looking more like a network than like a bus. And part of the way that happens is some of the packets you can send are routing packets, and there's all kinds of advanced routing stuff that is going to be released in the specification that I haven't seen yet. But there's no direct way for the OS to access that information. It's also used for all kinds of legacy stuff. So if the car generates a legacy interrupt, it sends a control packet. So you know, the OS can cause a message to be sent, but doesn't do it directly. It may turn out that there are good reasons to allow the OS to access control messages, and if so, we'll hammer out some kind of specification for how that's going to work. There are vendor reserve. There are messages reserved for vendors, and once we figure out how we're going to be able to generate those kinds of messages on the bus, we'll probably come up with some interface to allow vendors to generate those additional messages. So what do we have in configuration space? We've got the device configuration address. So before you can find out anything about a device, you've got to know how to find it. And the way that this works is that on any given bus, you can say, on this bus, ask device 9, function 0, what its manufacturer ID is. And it will either come back with a valid manufacturer ID, or it will come back with all Fs, indicating that there was no such device. So you need to be able to specify the bus number, the device number, and the function number. So what's this bit on the front? This is my fault. On some of the larger machines, such as HP and IBM, we have completely independent PCI buses. And they're so completely independent that you actually buy them in lumps this big and attach them into your supercomputer. So you have to have, and there's no way to deal with more than 256 buses, and it's entirely possible to plug in more than 256 buses to one of these larger computers. So we did consider renumbering buses and playing around with stuff, but in the end, it was easier just to do the same thing that firmware was doing and say, okay, this is in configuration space number 3. There's some debate over nomenclature, but we ended up calling that a PCI domain. The ACPI spec calls it a PCI segment, but they're wrong. So, there's some, when you go and talk to the device configuration space, there's a lot of standard stuff in there, and it's at standard positions. So you can go and ask it for its vendor and device IDs, and you can find out who sold you that card from the subsystem IDs. The great thing about PCI as compared to EISA, MCA, or ISA is there's no jumpers to set on the card, and there's no magic text file to load in off a floppy, and there's no fee to pay to IBM. So what PCI does is it allows the operating system and the firmware to configure where a card ends up in memory. And that's done through the base address registers, which are sitting in PCI config space. So a card can have up to 6 different, completely independent regions of memory or I/O space, which are programmed into it at boot time by firmware or at runtime by the operating system. There's an interrupt line. Well, there's 4 interrupt lines, int A, int B, int C, int D. And you can tell the card which one of those interrupt lines to use and it will come out as a different interrupt number to the CPU. There's control and status registers that just, you know, where the card tells you whether it's 66 megahertz capable, or whether it can do fast back-to-back, or whether it's detected a parity error or anything like that. And then they realized that they wanted to start standardizing more configuration capabilities than would actually fit into the standardized header, because the device had 192 bytes in which it could do whatever it wanted, but the first 64 bytes, they're sacred. They're defined by the PCI SIG. So in order to add new capabilities to the configuration space, there's a chain of registers running through the manufacturer-defined section of the configuration space. So this was a good compromise, rather than just starting to take random bits of the PCI configuration space and having manufacturers complain. It's like, okay, you can put these capabilities anywhere you want, you just chain them together on this list. So in addition to the interrupt lines I already talked about, PCI 2.2, I believe, introduced the message signaled interrupt. This has actually been made mandatory by PCI Express. All PCI Express devices must support either MSI or MSIX, which is, I believe, why we've suddenly seen a contribution from Intel giving us MSI support in Linux. So what is a message signal interrupt? Well, basically, rather than yanking this pin high or pushing this pin low, you do a write to just an ordinary memory map write, presumably to some piece of hardware on the host side that's then going to turn that into a CPU interrupt. Now, it very much depends on your architecture and how this is implemented. On PA RISC, for example, you could write directly to the processor's interrupt region and have it generate an interrupt. On i386, I believe that's performed by the IOX APIC. So as I said before, a lot of the old sideband signaling in PCI has been replaced by control messages in PCI Express. And here's one of the things that is replaced. It's that control messages are generated whenever a device tries to do a legacy interrupt. So memory mapped IO, which is great. You can do memory mapped reads, memory mapped writes, of course. But there's interesting variants on the theme. There's write and invalidate. And in order to use write and invalidate, you have to do things like program the card to know how big the CPU's cache line is. And when the card then does a write and invalidate transaction, the CPU knows it can invalidate whatever data it had in that cache line because it's just been overwritten. PCIX introduces the notion of split completions. So when you write to a device, it might not be ready yet. For whatever reason, it might not be able to accept that write. And so what it will do is it will, rather than insert wait states, which it's entitled to do, it's entitled to say, hang on a minute, hang on a minute, hang on a minute, hang on a minute, and just hold the bus, saying, no, I can't, no, I can't, no, I can't, until it has time to sort itself out. Rather than hogging the bus, it will say, can't do it. Call me in 5 minutes, and get back off the bus, and let another card use the bus instead. I'm not looking forward to explaining this. So, PCI has a producer-consumer ordering model. And what this means is that if you do a, if one device does a write to a second device, and then does another write to the second device, they are guaranteed to arrive in that order. However, if a if the CPU does a write to the second device, as measured on a logic analyzer, it happens strictly afterwards the first device write, then the order of those two transactions arriving is not guaranteed. And this is good enough. This is good enough for all existing systems. It doesn't guarantee. You could think about some very strange transactions where device one writes to the CPU and then the CPU writes to device two and that gets there before device one was write to device two. But in practice that doesn't happen and it's never proven to be a problem. You'd have to have some really weird system to even think about doing that. But this weak ordering is not good enough. For some larger systems. I know SGI have been, they started a thread on Linux PCI last week about introducing relaxed ordering. Relaxed ordering was also introduced in PCIX and has been carried forward to PCI Express. And what it does is actually allows writes, two writes from the CPU to bypass, to switch places, to switch orders. And this can be useful because it allows the PCI bridge, let's say if you do a write bytes 5 to 8 and then you write bytes 1 to 4, it allows that to combine it into a single write to bytes 1 to 8. This is fatal if you're writing control data, if you're programming the device to go and look over here for your DMA and then now generate an interrupt, and the now generation interrupt arrives before look over here for your DMA, you've just corrupted memory. But if you're just sending, let's say, an Ethernet packet down to the Ethernet card, then that's fine. It doesn't matter what order it arrives in, as long as it all arrives before the bit that says, and now send the packet. PCI Express goes a step further than this. It introduces traffic classes, and you can say it's kind of like if anyone's into networking, it's kind of like the service level in IP. You can say, okay, this data is in traffic class 0. It's not terribly important. But this data is in traffic class 7. That's tremendously important. Send that as fast as you can. And so that you specify that in the packet. Now, the packet is then sent over the PCI Express link. And the PCI Express link is composed of between 1 and 32 lanes. And those lanes are bundled together into virtual channels in a really, really complicated way, which the spec goes into in huge detail. And it's no fun at all to read and try and understand. But the rules are all there to make it kind of sane. And so you can bundle, let's say, four lanes together to give yourself a virtual channel 0 of 2 gigabytes a second. And then you can bundle the next 8 together to give yourself a virtual channel 1 of 4 gigabytes a second. Or you can just bundle them all together as a 12-lane 6 gigabytes a second traffic class 0. It all depends what you're trying to do, how you're trying to construct your system architecture. The system architecture of a laptop is very different from that of a Superdome. Now, PCI Express is designed to replace AGP, and that's where it's going to happen first. There are PCI Express graphics cards and chipsets coming out this year. This is very relevant to what you're going to be able to buy in the computer shop by the end of this year. And one of the things AGP has is what's called isosynchronous status, isosynchronous data. I looked at that word and I thought, is that the word's too long? I don't know what that means. So I went and looked it up in the glossary at the front. And that didn't mean much either. So I started reading the section saying, what is this? What does this really mean? What it turns out is a steady bandwidth requirement. You end up saying, I want to have at least 3 gigabytes a second between these two endpoints. And the system will tell you whether or not you can actually do that. As I said, this is a concept inherited from AGP, and it's something that's particularly relevant, you know, if you're doing streaming video playback to your screen, where you don't want to have any jerkiness, you can actually guarantee that. And one of the ways that's done is that the isosynchronous data is always in traffic class 7, and that's the highest traffic class available, it's highest priority. And by reading between the lines in the specification, the intent clearly is to put traffic class 7 on the highest bandwidth virtual channel available. And so guaranteeing that you'll be able to get your full motion video without any jerkiness. There's no guarantee of ordering between writes that go down. And if you've got two writes that are in different traffic classes, you're guaranteed there's no ordering requirement between the two. There may end up being ordering between the two simply because something in the middle doesn't have enough oomph to deal with it. But in theory, they're completely independent. Now I've got to order. PCMCIA. So, back in the dawn of time, we had 16-bit PCMCIA cards. PCMCIA, for those who don't know, stands for People Can't Memorize Computer Industry Abbreviations. Right. So, in the dawn of time, there came PCMCIA, which is 16-bit, and basically, this is an ISA bus. These pins form an ISA bus. But now we've all moved on, haven't we? Go out and buy yourself a wireless card. They're still using the bloody ISA bus. So, CardBus has exactly the same form factor as PCMCIA. The only difference is this notch here on the left-hand side is 2 units high rather than 1 unit high. And that's just to ensure that you can't plug a CardBus into a PCMCIA slot, into a 16-bit slot. But CardBus really is PCI. It's got PCI bus transactions, PCI configuration space. It's just the form factor that's different. In a way, this is very similar to the low-rise PCI and some of the embedded PCI stuff. But they're coming up with something new called Express Card. And this is basically PCI 1X, PCI Express 1X bus. 5 pins. No, sorry, 7 pins, because they put a clock in there as well. There are 7 pins on it that implement a 0.5 gigabytes a second link. that's going to be fast enough for a while. So they put some other stuff on it. They put a USB 2.0 connector on it, and they put SM bus, the system management bus, so you can do lots of system management type stuff, presumably power management can be done over that, and various other things. So that's all good. Express cards are going to come in two different variants. There's going to be the 54 millimeter ones, which will be exactly as wide as this, and a little bit shorter. They're going to take about five millimeters off the end of it. Which is good, because it means you can't put one into a PCMCIA socket and have it work. It will simply fail to connect. That's smart thinking. When you're designing for the consumer market, you've really got to think of these things. And the other variant drops quite a large chunk off the side of the card and ends up being 34 millimeters wide. It's much closer to the size of a VIO memory stick, let's say. But again, it won't be compatible with that. You won't be able to plug it into the wrong hole. I'm a little ashamed. Who knew? So I'd like to start by thanking Hewlett Packard, my employer, for sending me here. I'd like to thank the Ottawa Canada Linux Users Group, who I did a test run of this presentation on. And I'd like to thank you all for coming up. Any questions? I'm sorry, can you come up to the mic? I couldn't hear the last bit of that.
Yeah, sorry. With the PCI cards, the hard bus ones,
yeah.
Is there any extensions for allowing of hot plugging, basically?
Okay, so PCI in and of itself didn't have a whole lot to say about hot plug. PCI Express supports hot plug natively. As the physical layer protocol says, you know, when the card is being inserted, you may have voltages up to such and such and cope with it. What they do for card bus cards is that they have pins that are of different lengths. So you get power applied to the card before the address and data lines are connected, and they get connected before the reset line gets connected. So you're guaranteed to have, and because humans can only push a card so fast, there's actually sufficient time for all these things to happen and the card to prepare itself up before it gets put into a reset. Similar things are done on compact PCI in that they have the different length pins. For hot plugging regular PCI cards, what you do is you have a special PCI hot plug controller, and that can either be implemented in the root bridge or it can be implemented in a PCI to PCI bridge. And there will be special ways of telling that controller, okay, I'm going to plug something into slot number 3, please power it down. And it will power down slot number 3. You go along, push the card in, close the button, close the latch, press the button, and that will tell the controller to power that slot back up and perform a hot plug insertion. Good question. Thank you. One thing I forgot to mention. The bus bandwidth involved in all these things has changed considerably. If you look at the first PCI cards, they would be doing round about 120 megabytes a second peak, and that's an effective data rate of about 80 megabytes a second due to all kinds of protocol overheads. By the time you're getting up to PCI X133, you're looking at a gigabyte a second, and but because you've doubled the width to 64 bits from 32 bits, and you've quadrupled the speed of the bus, so you're up to probably around about 700 to 800 megabytes a second. PCI Express in its first release is going to support up to 16 gigabytes a second per car. So this considerably outperforms AGP, because AGP 8X is only doing 2 gigabytes a second. Any other questions? Does this mean we're going to see graphics accelerator read back from memory instead of just writing to it? I don't think so. I think we're going to see the technology shift back away from having, you know, 64 gig of RAM on your graphics card, and that's going to be in main memory instead. Because if you've got 16 gigabytes a second of bandwidth, why the hell not? Andrew. Okay, so the question was whether we're going to see cards, whether we're going to see laptops with the entirety of all four sides having connectors. I don't think we're going to see that. I think we'll see. This is such a dangerous thing to say. I think we're going to see laptops transition away. The point about the different sizes of the Express cards coming in, a 34 millimeter card will fit into a 54 millimeter slot. They're designed to do that. And even if you start pushing it in the wrong angle, the internal connector will push it away and into the right slot. So I think we're going to see laptops with simply one PCI Express slot. Okay, so the question is that Compact Flash is an IDE device, which a Compact Flash adapter card is an IDE device, which takes the ISA PCMCIA bus and translates it onto the Compact Flash. I don't think this is going to be a problem, because I think we will see these are basically IDE devices more than anything. And we're clearly going to see PCI Express IDE devices, because serial ATA is going to need it. Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what I think will happen. Yeah. No. So no, I think they're going to deal with that in the Compact Flash to Express card adapters. I think it's just been more convenient and cheaper to do this at 16-bit. But it looks to me like the Express cards are going to be cheaper to implement than doing 16-bit cards, and as we know, cheaper wins. Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming.